Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about the kernel part of the context. So you mentioned that when we talked about how exceptions worked in general, one of the things we did just to handle an exception, like a system call where we go back to the program, is we, before we ran the kernel code, save the program's state, and then we stored it before we returned, just, you know, kind of like an extension of a function call, how you save, you know, registers that you might overwrite and then restore them. And this turns out in XP6 to be exactly how we implement the user mode part of a context switch, that we take advantage of the fact, well, we're already saving and restoring everything. So that's going to just save and restore what the application was doing originally. But we also have to deal with the kernel part, that when we're writing some code that decides, oh, time to run a different program, we need to save where we were in the first program in the kernel, in the operating system code, so we can go back to it later, and also restore where we were in some other program. And basically, we're saving all the registers and restoring them. And XP6 had this implementation trick where they had this function that you call from one thread and it returns in another. And later on you call it and it can return in the original thread. And the implementation of this function took a lot of advantage of the fact that, well, you know, function calls save a bunch of registers. They also save where to return to. And that's exactly how, you know, half the registers are saved and also where to return to in the new thread is saved, or we're to return to when we go back to the original thread is saved. And the function just needed to do the work of saving the remaining registers so things would work. Then we also mentioned, okay, so we know about this information about saved registers, where are we going to store that? And we stored a pointer to that in what we call a thread control block. And we also need to store some other information about a thread, like, you know, is it running or not? So can we switch to it? We have some ID numbers. We also need to have information about processes that contain threads, like what files they have open and things like that. And we call the structure in which these are stored for a thread control block, for a process control block. We mentioned in XP6, these are kind of confused because XP6 only supports processes with exactly one thread. And because of that, they have this struct proc that's both a process control block and the thread control block for that single thread in the process. And in an operating system that supported multiple threads per process, we separate those out and have our process control block contain basically an array of thread control blocks. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Does the compiler determine whether all of the arguments when system calls made are passed through to registers, or whether like, some additional things are controlled like that, or is that governed by like, the size of?
So the question is, what determines where the arguments to system calls are stored? Is it the compiler, or is it something else? So there's a decision made by the operating system about where arguments to system calls go. And in XP6, like many operating systems, has made the decision that they want it to be as simple as possible to write code that calls system calls. So they're going to expect the arguments the same place we'd expect them for a normal function call. And because they made that decision, their decision is to do what, you know, the compiler does to pass arguments as far as where we expect arguments. And that's a very common decision you'll see other OSs make, too, just because it simplifies things. But they could have made another decision, and if they did that, then our system call wrapper would need to do some translation, like might need to copy arguments to a different location. Does that answer your question? Yes. Can I talk about question three on the quiz? So question three on the quiz is asking, we have a list of events, and I'm asked which of these most likely involves an exception other than a system call. So one of these is that we have, so I guess I'll talk about the ones which seem to cause the most confusion. So I guess I should talk about all of them because we have at least 15% missing all of them, most of them. Okay, so a key is pressed and process A starts running. So when the key is pressed and that causes process A to start running, there's not some event in the currently running program, which was initially B in the question, to do that. So it must mean something external. So that's something where the hardware ran the OS despite the current program not running that has to be an exception and that can't be a system call because it wasn't requested by process B. If process A asks for data to be sent over the network, so what process A basically made a read system call, a system call saying, please run me later when you have data sent over the network. Process A asked to be data sent over the network. So process A made a write system call. So the write system call, the OS handled it, maybe it communicated with a network device or set up to communicate with a network device. But there's nothing in particular which requires other exceptions to happen to do that operation, right? The asking is making a system call. If something happened to later on trigger the OS to do something, it's not in that description. And communicating with the device doesn't need an exception necessarily. The exception is if the device needs to run the OS in a special way. And that's not something that we're saying needs to happen here. And then C, process A asked to wait for a response from the network causing process B to run it. So process A here made a read system call, basically, saying, I want to read some data from the network. And the OS said, well, I don't have data for you, let me run process B. At some point in the future, process A is probably going to need to be run by the OS and probably in response to input from the network. That's going to involve an exception, but that hasn't happened yet. That's a later event on this list. In fact, it's the event in D. So C is a system call setting us up how we're going to respond to a non-system call exception later, but that non-system call exception doesn't happen until the next step. Yes? Question, when we're causing B to start running, isn't that a context switch? Yes, it is. And context switches are not in themselves exceptions. Because remember, when we do a context switch, an exception already happened, and then we decided to do a context switch. So that's not an extra exception because there's a context switch. A context switch is a thing we might do in response to an exception. It's not an exception itself. Yes? Question? So question is, context switch is not actually an exception? Yes. So context switch we often do as part of handling an exception, but it is not itself an exception. Yes? Can I go over question four? Let me finish going over question three first. So our last point of confusion is the last option, that A asked to wait for input from the keyboard, causing B to start running. So again, this is the same example as waiting for input from the network. It made a read system call, and later on, but we haven't seen it yet, there's going to be a non-system call exception that causes the OS to switch back to A, most likely, but that doesn't happen yet. All the OS has done is handle the system call by deciding to make a context switch. So there's a system call exception, and part of that system call is a context switch. Okay, so other questions about question three before? Yes? Question in A and D, what are the exceptions other than a system call happening? So in both of these, there's no system call. So in A, if process A starts running, but we're running process B, then process A must have made a system call earlier, asking to be run when there's a key press. And the key press triggered a system call because the hardware caused the OS to run to handle the key press. And in D, the hardware caused the OS to run to handle network input. Yes. So the question is, when we did an exercise on the first day of class, we had an exercise of counting exceptions, and there was an event where the program B switched to C, and we said that had an exception. So in order to do a context switch between processes, we have to be in kernel mode. There has to be some exception involved. But we do it as part of an exception which happens for some other reason, like a timer going off or a key press happening. So the reason in that exercise we knew there was an exception is we said, well, something triggered us to switch from B to C, and that something must have been an exception. Does that answer your question? So then, on question four. So here, the setup is that we have two variables, A and B, which represent, which represent contexts. So they're going to be, because of how switch works, pointers to a stack. And we're saying B points to a stack that is set up as if we called switch just before running thread B. So we have some code that calls switch to set B, meaning that the first argument of that call to switch is B, and then calls thread B. And that's how B is set. So we're saying how B is set. We're not actually saying that thread B is run yet, because we're just saying that B is set as if there was that call to switch. And it says as if, so maybe there actually was one, or maybe this is how we started the new thread. Because remember, when we create a new thread, we set up this sort of fake call stack that pretends we're in the middle of a call to switch. And then what actually happens is thread A is called, this function thread A. So we call thread A, and we're asked what happens before thread A returns. So if thread A returns, when we reach this this close brace right here. So we're going to print 1. That's the first line of thread A that's called. And then we do this switch call. And we're going to save where we are in A, because that's the first argument to switch. And we're going to restore where B saved. And B saved a call stack that's about to call thread B. So we're going to go back to a stack where we're calling thread B. So then we're going to call thread B and print 3. And then we're going to switch to where we just saved an A here and save where we were in B. So we switch back to A, and we're going to print return from this call to switch, because that's where we previously saved something in A. And then we're going to print 2, and then we're going to return from A, and that's it. It's true that there's this print 4 in B in the thread B function. Maybe we'll get to that later on, but that's after we return from the thread A function. Yes?
What does the first sentence mean?
This question, what does this first sentence mean? So B points to a call stack, and the call stack is set up as if, so the same way it would be, by a call to switch made just before calling thread B. So that first thing before the comma is just, how is B set? So B is set that way, and then we call thread A.
Wait, do we not call thread B before thread A, though?
That is, does not happen, because if we actually called switch, it would not run thread switch before then, and without doing something else, it would not run thread B, because it would switch to something else, unless we switch back. And because it's as if it was set up that way, and it's only supposed to be about the value of B. Now, I think some people read this as B initially points to a call stack, and it initially points just before calling thread B. That's a little weird because we're specifying it initially points and just before calling thread B points. But if you read it that way, then you have a problem. Because then you're saying thread B is called first, before thread A. And if we call thread B, then we're going to run this call to switch that's in thread B, switching to A, and we haven't told you how A is set. And you should have written unknown. Because A is not set to anything. And that call is going to jump somewhere crazy. Does that answer your question, follow-ups? When I say B points to call stack, I mean this variable B that's a context here.
So it's the input of the thread function.
Good. Yeah, so it's, so B is one of the arguments to the switch function, as is A. Yeah, those are the A and B that we're referring to here. Yes?
So essentially this switch does saving the address of B for, save this function as the address of A, and then basically jump to the address.
So saying that the call the switch that we have in thread A is save the address where we are in A and jump to B, that's what it does.
I see.
Yes, back there. So you're saying that you said, you assumed that when thread B was called, that A was initialized.
So A was at that switch statement point. So we sort of started running B first. We printed out 3, and then we switched to A from that to that switch after that switch statement because no other relevant code called switch. So it must have been that switch statement that ran.
Must have been that switch statement. So we switched to we ran thread 3 here, and then we switched to where in A. Okay. So I would say that's not calling thread A, because calling a function starts at the beginning. And that's a big problem I see with that. Does that make sense? And also, there's a question of how that would be set up and still not, and have thread A, when it set that up, not break, right? Because if we have this call the switch didn't break, you know, didn't crash, then B would have to have been initialized for that to work. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Back there? So the question is about creating the comments. So at some point, I'm going to have a TA try to make a rubric for this and go through the comments and the wrong answers. But that has not happened yet because we can't do that in 20-30 minutes. We haven't decided what we're doing as far as partial credit goes, because I'm going to have my TA give me a draft of what they want to do. Yeah.
So the statement, no exceptions occur while this code is running, does that imply that A must have been initialized to some reason?
The statement that no exceptions occur while this code is running. So if we just call thread A, then it's going to initialize A. So there's no need for any exception to do that. If you interpret it to start with thread B, then that would mean that this switch call switches to somewhere that doesn't trigger an exception. And you wouldn't know what that is. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Okay.
So for answer B, I'm a little confused why that is not a system call, because since it's
so the question is why answer D is not a system call. Answer D is not a system call. So at this point in time, process B is running. And process B doesn't care about the network. So any event that runs, that does something based on the network while process B is running, can't be a system call because process B is not making any request about the network. Does that make sense? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
So we've got a question more about the exceptions not occurring. So the reason that an exception doesn't occur when you go back to thread A, when you go to thread B from the switch A,
so the question is, why doesn't an exception occur when we're calling switch in this code? Why is that assumption okay? So the switch function doesn't do anything that actually triggers an exception. It just changes registers. So there's nothing that triggers an exception in there. So as long as things are set up so we don't like have a null pointer to reference or something like that, there's no reason to have an exception. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so let's go on to our main topic for today. So last time we looked at our process control block, we mentioned we have, you know, so this sort of structure that stores information about, you know, threads and where they are, and also information about processes, open files, what memory is allocated, process IDs. Also, we'll see some related processes. In XV6, this is in a struct proc, and we saw in some code we looked at for system calls, this function myproc that got a pointer to the current struct proc. And the way that works, this is the code for that myproc function, is that there's this array of this struct CPU for every processor, every core, I should say, that XV6 is running on, and XV6 retrieves the element of this array based on which core we're on. So basically, there's a separate myproc value for each core, and the myproc function retrieves it based on what core we're currently running on. And that's why it's not a real global variable, so we can have a different value for each core. So questions on myproc, this idea of a separate value for each core. Yeah? So what do I mean by this being a global variable? So we have this global array with one element per core, and what myproc does is it looks up the array based on which core we're on. So if we're on core 0, we'll look up index 0. On core 1, we'll look up index 1, and it retrieves that value. So it's almost a global variable, but it's different on each core because we just use the index. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so it's really a global array indexed by the core ID. Yeah. So this global array stores the current, a pointer to the current struct proc, to the current process control block. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah.
Wait, so this thing that we're retrieving from this global array is the, like, what exactly are we getting from this, like, global array?
What are we getting from this global array? So there's this thing called a struct CPU, which, among other things, has a pointer to the currently running process on that core. Does that answer your question? We're probably not going to be concerned about the other things until much later. Yeah.
What is myproc?
So this is a function we've seen in code we saw for system calls to retrieve the current process. Okay. So that's on XV6. So now I'm going to go away from talking about how kernel stuff works for, at least talking at a low level, how kernel stuff works. And we're going to talk about Unix stuff. And we've been focusing on Unix-like OSs because we have source code, because you've been using them probably in 2150, and because our teaching OS, XV6, imitates Unix. And you might say, well, what is Unix? So there was this is a sort of timeline of Unix-like OSs. So there was an original version of Unix made by AT&T in the late 60s, early 70s. And then there's a whole bunch of OSs that are based on that, some of which, shown by the lines here, share actual source code with each other. And yes, there are really are lines in kind of both directions. So yes, like there was a Unix OS that took code from another Unix OS. And it's a mess how the code actually got mixed around. And then there were OSs which weren't based on the original Unix source code, such as Linux here, that even though they're not based on the same original code, try to implement the same interface and the same basic design. So there's this whole big family of OSs. These days, probably the only ones you're likely to know about are Linux and Mac OS X, which are in this family, but there used to be a lot of them. And in particular, in the 80s and 90s, pretty much everything on this diagram was commercially viable. And as you might imagine, as a software developer, this is kind of a mess, because you have these similar OSs, but they're not quite the same. So there's something that all the Unix manufacturers did, because they all had this sort of very, very similar OSs. and they made a standard called POSIX, which stands for Portable Operating System Interface. And basically what they did is they made a standard version of Unix. And there's a current version of this online, last updated in 2017, that specifies what this POSIX, this Unix interface is, which is meant to be sort of a universal idea of what Unix is that will work with all the implementations, regardless of what changes they made since the original version or whether they re-implemented everything. So you might say, so this is a standard Unix, but notice that it's a standard interface. So POSIX defines how the libraries work, like the standard library. So like we saw write, and so, for example, so it defines those sorts of things, and how the shell works, how the command line works. It's focused on source code compatibility. It doesn't define how things work. So it says there's a function called write that you can use to output stuff. It doesn't say if that's a system call or not. It, in a traditional Unix implementation like XV6, it makes a system call. But POSIX doesn't care. They just care that if you make a call to write, it does that. It does the thing where it will output to the terminal sometimes. It doesn't specify binary format. So the idea of the POSIX standard was that if you're a software manufacturer, you can write one piece of source code and build it for Solaris, HPUX, and every other variant of Unix being sold, but you would have to recompile it for each one. They weren't trying to get compatibility where you'd actually ship the same executable. And as I said, in the 80s and 90s, this was a really important goal because there was no dominant Unix-like OS. So these days, people usually just say, oh, if it works on Linux, that's all I care about for like server software. But back in the 80s and 90s, if you were writing server software, you needed to make server software that worked on all these different Unix-like OSs if you wanted to sell it commercially. So this was pretty helpful for that. Questions on what POSIX is? Yes?
How does this impact operating systems like Windows?
So how does it impact operating systems like Windows? So Windows and several other OSs have made various attempts at compatibility layers for POSIX and for a long time. Sort of Windows's most current attempt is the Windows subsystem for Linux, which is actually fairly complete, but they've had sort of lesser attempts at this for a long time. So it is very common for other OSs to try to implement part of POSIX. And I would say that even though there's a standard, you know, compliance is not 100%. But most of the Unix-like OSs really try. Other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk about, in particular, we talked about processes. We're going to talk about the interface for managing processes in POSIX. And we're going to primarily talk about these library functions, which typically would correspond directly to a system call. So as I said, POSIX doesn't say what is and isn't a system call, but in the traditional Unix that it's based on, these were turned directly into system calls. And we'll start with simplest one, so get PID. So this is getting information about the current process. So it's a function that takes no arguments and returns the process ID, commonly called the PID of the current process, which is a number. It's a number with the type PIDT. Why does it have that type? Because POSIX didn't want to specify whether it's an int or a long or a short, so they just made a type def for it. And you include a header file, and that's some sort of integer, but you don't know which. So questions about get PID. And this means that every process has a unique number. Same with the OS. Yes? The question is, does this specify an ID for each program? So this is the ID for each running process. So when you create a new process, when you start a program, the OS is going to assign a unique ID to it. POSIX doesn't specify how that number is assigned. It could be a counter, it could be something else. And the reason we need this is that there's going to be other operations where we need to specify what process we want to do something to. And this is how we're going to do that. Okay. And on a Unix-like system, typically there's an application called PS, which will list running programs. So this would probably remind you of like the task manager in Windows, same sort of idea. And it lists them with their PID and some other information. Okay, so that's fairly simple, yes. Does PS stand for anything? I think it's processes, but I'm not sure. Yes?
Does
getPID
actually create a new process?
So, does the getPID create a new process? No. It retrieves information about your current process. So, in XV6, it's reading from your current process's control block this value and returning it to you. So now we'll talk about actually creating a process. And you'll notice here, and this is a preview of something which is going to be a bit confusing. In POSIX, creating a process is separate from running a program. And we'll get to what that means later. But we're going to start with creating a new process, which is done with a call called fork. So what fork does is it copies the current process. So that's how you create a new one. You just make a copy of the current one. And it returns twice, because we have two processes now. Returns once in the original process, which is called the parent, and once in the copy, which is called the child. And it returns different values in each one, which is how you can have code which does something different in the new process versus the old one. But everything else is duplicated, including where we are running in the current thread. That's why it returns twice. And all the values in memory, all our opened files, all our registers, they're all copied. So sort of as a pictorial point of view, we can imagine we're running a program and we have a process control block. It contains the registers from our, if we're thinking of a single threaded process from our current, from the thread, it contains like a stack pointer for the kernel. It contains our active memory. It has our list of open files and a bunch of other information. And fork is going to copy that, and it's going to be a deep copy. So in addition to copying this process control block, we're going to copy the things it points to. So we're going to have a new kernel stack and a new memories values. It's going to be a deep copy for our new process. And we want to, as mentioned, return different things in the two processes, so we can do different things and depending on whether we're running the new process or the old one. So we're going to change our return value, which is just in x86, added in the EAX register differently depending on whether we're in the original or the new one. Yes? So what is copy versus a deep copy? So by a deep copy, I mean that even though we have a pointer to our kernel stack and a pointer to our memory, we copy the kernel stack and memory itself, even though it's not part of the process control block proper. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Is EAX storing the parent process ID or?
Question, what is EAX storing? So what the function returns is that in the original process, it returns the new PID. In the new process, the child process, it returns zero. So a way I remember this is that we can get the PID of the process we're running in with getPID. So it tells us the PID we couldn't get if we need it. So in the child process, we already know what the new PID is because we can call getPID. So do you get that? In the parent process, we would have no other way of knowing it, so it returns that value to us. Does that answer your question?
What if you fork the same program twice? What do you store?
Question, what if we fork the same program twice? Then we have two different calls to fork, and we can stash the return values in different places. Yes?
How can we copy the registers?
How can we copy the registers? So in XV6, This would be copying the trap frame.
So, but I guess, okay, so the value in the register is just copied to the memory, and then you just keep track, that's in the register.
So the values in the trap frame are copied to the memory. So you're saying, like, we're just, can you rephrase that?
Like, for example, like, because, like, one register, is the register we're talking about the physical register or the logical register?
Question, what register values? I'm talking about the physical or logical. I'm talking about the register values that would be visible in the assembly in the program calling fork.
So basically, like, for example, EAX so far, like, holds the value for the parent process, the value is 42. And then it cannot hold the value for the program, right? So where's that value recorded?
So the question is, where are the register values recorded? So if we're thinking about our process control block, on XV6, we have this trap frame which points to our save registers, right? And in XV6, they happen to be on the kernel stack. So we just copy that kernel stack, if we were doing something like that, and copy that those trap frame values. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, does it have different address translation? Yes. So we see that we have, like, the user memory is copied, so it has to be relocated. So there's a bunch of, like, fixing up pointers that I'm not showing that needs to be done to, like, deal with the address space changing and so on. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, so I was showing the value before we finished. So when you finish the fork call, whatever was in EAX before is changed. I put 42 in just to show that it has an initial value that's unrelated to the short value. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you explain why the EAX and the child process is set to 0?
Why is it set to 0? That's just the convention POSIX shows is that it returns 0 from the child process, so you know you're in the child process. It's just a signal about which process you're running. Yes?
Is the PID stored in each control block, or is it stored by like?
Question, where are the PIDs of program stored? So the PID is stored in each control block, so we'll have a PID field I haven't shown, which will be set to some value, and the PID field in the child will be set to the new PID. That's part of my focus. Yes?
How did they decide what the new, like, child PID is going to be?
How do they decide what the new child PID is going to be? So POSIX, as I mentioned, the standard, it says the OS can do whatever it wants. And in practice, common strategies include a counter or a random number. And the only thing you have to be careful about is you have to check for duplicates, because you can't have two processes with the same PID. Yes? Can we call fork twice in succession? Absolutely.
So what does the PID, what's the return value for the parent? Because you have two.
So each time, so question, what's the return value when we call fork twice? So each one is a separate call which has a parent, which is who the original process that called it, and a child. And, you know, it will have the same relationship that the child process from a particular call to fork will always get 0, and the parent will always get the new PID. The question, if there's one parent and two childs, the way that would work is to be two separate calls to fork, and we'd look separately at each of them to see what the return value is in each case. Yes?
Can you get a parent PID from a child?
Can we get the parent PID from a child? Yes. So there's a POSIX library call called getppid, which does that. Other questions? Yeah.
Where is that parent ID stored?
Where is that parent ID stored? POSIX doesn't care. But most commonly in the process control block, there will be a pointer to the parent process. But hypothetically, the implementation could do something like save it before fork. Yeah.
So
Because when you copy the original, it has a pointer to the copy that generally, we'll see why later. But so far, we haven't actually had any reason to do that. But there's going to be a reason why that's typically done. We'll see when we talk about processes terminating. Other questions? OK, so let's talk about fork. So here's an example that uses fork. So I have a program where I first print out my PID of what will be for this call of fork, the parent process. And then I call fork. And if the child PID is greater than 0, meaning that fork returned me a new PID, I must be in the parent process. And it told me about the new process that it spawned. And in that case, I'm going to print out, you know, PID and parent of the child PID and the child. I'm going to get the PID with a separate get system call because fork just told me 0, meaning the flag that says you're in the child process now. I'm going to print out the child. And I have this else case because fork can fail. And I say, why can it fail? Most common reason is if we're out of memory. If we're out of memory, it's going to return -1. So we detect that situation. So we have our get PID calls. And I'm doing some casting here. This is just because I don't know the size of integer PIDT is, so I cast it to make sure printout works correctly. Because it might be like a long or a short, something like that. Yes?
So after fork returns from the child process, does the PID change from 0 to something else?
After fork returns from the child process, does this PID change from 0 to something else? No. Fork returns 0 just as a flag to the child process. It's not, so it's just like a special value to indicate you're the child. It's not meant to represent a real PID. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
How did fork return twice
here? So how does fork return twice? Because we copied the process. So we have two processes whose registers and stacks are both, and memory is both set up about to return to fork. And we're going to context switch to both of them at some point. Does that answer your question? So question is, how can we have two different return values?
Yeah.
And that's going to be not a problem because we've copied the memory in which those return values are stored. So there's two different places to store return values after we do all this copying.
But in the code, don't you just have child ID equals fork?
Question, in the code, don't we have child ID equals fork? Yes. But when this runs, we're going to have two copies of our stack after a fork is called. And on one of those copies, we can have one version of child PID, and another one will have a different version of child PID. Yes?
What's going on inside fork?
What's going on inside fork? It's doing this copying. And we're going to kind of gloss over some of the details, because they vary between implementations. Yeah?
So fork basically does do a copy on yourself, because whoever calls it. Like,
yeah, so the question is, fork copies whoever calls it? Yes. So we have our code here. Oh, I should mention perror is a function that prints an error message. And in POSIX, system calls that fail set a special variable called errNull, which indicates what type of error. And perror outputs that as a human-readable message, like resource temporarily unavailable, or arguably human-readable message, like resource like that. Yes?
How do you know? Because like in your function, child PID is the PID of the parent or the child. Is there no way of knowing definitively which PID fork will return?
Question, is there no way of knowing definitively which PID fork will return? So fork always returns 0 in the child process, which is why I have this equals 0, we're in the child process. And if it returns a positive number, it's always a new process ID, and it also means that you're running in the parent process. Does that answer your question?
So child PID, so is that 0 or the return value of the child?
The question, the return value of fork is 0 in the child. The actual PID, you notice to be retrieved by calling get PID from the child. Because what fork returned is just indicating that we don't have any child's process that was created because we aren't.
So the child's actually
The child actual PID is a new ID, yeah. Actual new number, yeah.
In what case will you have returned the first one? There's a, you read, the one you call for, it returns a parent process. What's a child PID greater than zero?
Question, why is child PID greater than zero? So if fork created a new process and you're in the original process, it returns the ID of the new process. If you're in the original process, fork returns the ID of the new process.
So it's not deterministic. Like you could either return the parent process or return the child process.
It's a question. It's not deterministic. You return the parent process or child process. I wouldn't say that. It returns in both. They both run because they're now both separate threads that can be switched to. Which one will run first? That is non-deterministic. Yes.
But they run like their sequence can be indeterminate.
Yeah, their sequence can be non-deterministic, so I have one output here, and here I print the parent PID as 100, and then apparently the parent process ran and printed out the child PID was 432, and then the child process ran and printed out that it was the child process with ID 432, and you are correct that this could happen in a different order because it depends on when we context switch, like when timers go off and so on. Which is why this is only an example output in addition to the IDs being made up. Yes? Sorry, which? So which shell commands often use fork? Pretty much everyone, because this is the standard way of starting a new process. If you want to start a new process, this is the thing. So you might say, wait a moment, but this doesn't run a different program. We'll get to that later. So now, about fork. Here I have some code that uses fork, and as mentioned, it depends what order when we switch from one program to another, which like we mentioned happens like on a timer. So my question is based on that, what are two possible outputs of this, which are just gonna be different ways we can order when these things are run? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree. Okay, who'd like some more time? Who can give me one possible output? So, yeah. Okay. So, okay. Done, done. Okay, so that's an input where we interleave the two. So what happens is we call fork, and then we switch to the child process for a bit, then we switch, then like it took too long and we switch back to the parent process. The parent process runs child 100, then we switch back to the child process, or maybe not, and we're undone and switch back. That's one possible. Come give me another possible output. Other possible outputs. Yes. Child 100, done, in child, done. So you're saying one other possibility is the parent returns first from fork and keeps going until it finishes, and then we switch to the child. And that's another thing which could happen. And so there's a whole bunch of different outputs. And the sort of way I visualize this is what's the uncertainty is that we don't know like when the OS will decide to switch, which is probably based on like when a timer goes off, and that's gonna vary depending on how fast things are running. And when exactly when we switch will change the output we get. Yes? Question, there's more than two possible outputs? Yes. So the important thing is that we can't print done until the thing before it is printed in whatever process we're in. So there's not, so if you're printing done in the first two steps, that's a problem, but otherwise, the first step, that's a problem, but otherwise, there's a lot of other possible outputs, yes.
So when a function returns twice, you're basically running the first one twice.
So question, when the fork function returns, we're running that twice? So yeah, all the code afterwards runs twice, with the only difference being the value of that return value. And it runs interleave with each other, depending on when the OS decides to context switch. Yes?
Wait, why is it not 99?
Why is it not 99? Because fork returns the idea of the new process. Okay. The way I think about this is that it returns the information the parent couldn't get itself. Right? The parent could remember its own ID before forking, and the child could remember the parent's ID before forking, but there's no way the parent could figure out the new ID without it being returned from fork. Other questions? Yeah.
So exactly,
so the question is, fork creates a new thread? Yes. That's exactly what it does. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've talked about creating new processes, but we've done so in what seems like maybe not a very useful way. Because if you think of like what you most commonly think as creating a new process, you think of like running the ls command or starting the program, your compiler. And this seems not actually very useful for that because we're not running a new program. We're running the same program in a new process. So how are we going to run a different program? And the POSIX way of doing that is a bunch of functions whose names start with exec for execute. And exec, you notice I'm not saying it creates a new process. So what it does is in the current process, it replaces the current program you're running with a new one. So it's going to be in the same process control block. We're just going to overwrite that process control block with a new program to be running. And we're going to talk mainly about this variant of exec, but there's a bunch of others you can look up. This is just one that I think is probably the easiest variant to use. So it's called execv. It takes a path, so which is the file to run. So like this would be the path to your executable. And then it takes argv, which is the value to pass as argv to main. Or the array of values, I should say, terminated by a null pointer. Yes?
When you say terminated by a null pointer, do you mean that the array itself is terminated by a null pointer?
Question, do I mean the array itself is terminated by a pointer or each instance? I'm not sure what you mean by instance, but we'll have examples of how we can set argv, which will hopefully clarify the format. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there a difference between a program and a process?
Is there a difference between a program and a process? Yes. So we're not going to create a new process here. We're going to make the current process be running a different program. So for example, if I have my hello world program, and if it called execv, it's going to stop running the hello world program and be running whatever executable I put in path. But it's going to be the same process. It's going to have the same process ID. It's going to use the same process control block. It's just that that process control block is going to be overwritten with values from the new program. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What's the definition of a process image? Process image is basically the memory contents that we expect a program to have. So this function replaces basically the entire memory of a process and all the save registers and so on with new values. Yeah.
So why don't shells use this instead of using the other thing?
So question, why don't shells use this instead of using the other thing? They use both. So the classical way in Unix to start a new program is to use both fork and exec. So what you'll typically see is we'll call fork to create a new process. And in that new process, so we have a new process control block, we'll call exec to make it run a different program. So this is typically what a shell will do. So this would be how we run ls minus l. So you see, we fork to spawn a new process. And in that new process, we run bin ls, that's the ls executable, with the argv values of ls and minus l, and we have this terminating null pointer to say there's only two arguments. And yes, by convention, the program name is always argv of 0, the first element of that array. And since execv replaces the current program, if it returns, something went wrong. We didn't actually start running ls. Because if we start running ls, well, we're not running our current program anymore. We're not going to run the code afterwards. So that's why I have here, if we return here, it failed. So I just print out an error message and exit. And otherwise, I have my parent process to keep running my shell after this is done. Yes? Question, when I run exec, this program is killed. I wouldn't put it that way. So if we think of our process control block, when we run exec, we have our process control block running our current program. Exec, as I said, overwrites it. So after exec returns, my original program, my original sort of running program is no longer running what it was running.
Basically,
exec,
instead of killing,
it's
basically replacing all the...
Yes. So question, exec, instead of killing, is replacing everything? Yes. So the original stuff no longer exists. Yes, over there.
So when we do fork and the child process is created, does the parent get killed or does that stay?
Question, when we do fork and the child process is created, does the parent get killed? No. The parent still runs, so this code in this example with the dot 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 will run, and we'll see what we want to do with that later, which probably is this waiting for process to finish thing. Okay, and your question there? Behind you, yeah. Is there a method you can do this all in one call? We'll see an example later, but it's usually not used. Yes?
So this seems kind of like an inefficient implementation, right? Currently, maybe for to copy all the memory of the parent application.
So the question is, isn't this really inefficient? So as I've described it, yes. There are things we'll talk about when we talk about virtual memory which make it not so inefficient, but still probably yes. Even though it's not so bad. So there are alternative APIs, and we may look at them briefly. Yes?
So why did duplicate the current process every single time you run?
So the question is, why are we duplicating?
So why do we even use fork when we can just keep changing the current process?
Question, why do we use fork when we keep changing the current process? So your proposal would be that we just exec ls. But the problem is if we're running something like a shell, then we can't go back to our shell prompt unless ls knows to do that. Right, because ls is just going to exit, and that's not going to help us. Because exiting is not going to go back to the shell, the original program. So if our goal is to run a program and then do something else, we need to have a new process to do it, because if we just run something else, that something else isn't going to go back to us, most likely, unless it's written to do that. Yes?
If in order to create a child, we need a parent to copy from, how How do we get like the first?
This question, how do we get the first process? We'll talk about that briefly, but the short answer is there's some special code in the OS to run a first process. Typically, it's called init on a Unix system. Yes?
Isn't it always the usual case that you can type a command without using a string notation box in the shell
back to wait? When we run a command in the shell, don't we have to like wait for it to finish?
Yeah.
Yes, but it's still run as a separate process. And what will happen is that some code run in this dot, dot, dot here will wait for the child process to finish. And we'll see an example of that later. How do we turn if we're in the child process or the parent process? The return value of fork.
Yeah, but why would it be different?
Why would it be different? Because that's how fork is defined. It returns one value in the child process, one value in the parent process. Question, should the fork method always be consistent when it's returning? The fork always returns twice. It is consistent, it consistently returns one, those two different values every time you call it. And we just want to detect which case we're in, or the fork, or are we in the parent return or the child return? Yes?
Do we need to manually kill the child?
So if binls exits, it will terminate. So no. Yeah? Okay, so the question is it just a coincidence that this here doesn't match this? No. That is deliberate. We have to supply an actual file name here, even though when you're running a shell, like you might not type the whole thing. So one of the things the shell will do, your command prep will do, is it will look up where the executable is to construct that first argument to exec v. Does that answer your question?
Not entirely, but I think I should.
So you'll type ls, and ls will be what will pass in argv0 to indicate the user typed ls. But to actually run the program, we need its path, where it is in the file system. Okay, so we talked about exec. We mentioned that basically just replaces all the values in the current process control block with step forward to start a new program. So we like set all the registers to their initial values. We allocate a new stack and heap. And we load all the code and global variables from the executable file and go back there. Rather than returning to the original program, which now is not running what it was running before, assuming exec succeeds. And we just throw away everything the original program was running. We also have to do a little extra work of copying the arguments to make it work. And notably, one thing we don't change is the open files. So, you know, if standard in is the terminal, it's still the same terminal after exec. It doesn't change that. It's not part of loading a new program. Yes? Question, what happens in here if we go into the parent process? We haven't talked about it yet here. We will talk about it later. So this is just what exec does when we call it. Okay. And then we discard the old memory. So some of you asked the question, isn't exec really expensive? Couldn't we have just a function to call create a new program? Absolutely. Windows has create process, which does the create a new process running a particular thing all in one operation. And POSIX has one called POSIX spawn, which you will almost never see used. But it exists. The complication of using an API which has this one function to create a new process and run a program in that new process is that we need a way to set all the processes state. So let's say, for example, I want to run binls, but I want to run it in a particular directory. Now I need an argument to my create a new process running something function to say what directory. I want to specify like where, what terminal its input comes from. I need another argument to specify that. So the complication is that, you know, if we want to customize the new program state, if we want to run it in a particular directory with particular input, that's going to complicate this call. And that's probably why the Unix designer said we're going to have this fork and exec. Because the idea is you fork, And before you exec, you can change things. You can like change what directory you're in. You can open files and so on, rather than having to have this be something that's supported by that create process call that does both at once. But it has the big disadvantage that we need to have the OS have this copy everything code, which maybe is a problem. So I mentioned that POSIX spawn exists. So POSIX spawn, so it does kind of what you'd expect. You say a program to run and an argv, and also there's some extra arguments, which here I've left as null, but where you can specify things like open some new files, change directories, and so on. But yes, it exists, but pretty much no one uses it because it's not widely supported. And most commonly, POSIX spawn, it's a library call, so POSIX doesn't say how it's implemented, and you'd hope that it'd be implemented by doing something better than forking, but often, no, it actually just forks inside its implementation. Because fork was written first, this was came out much later. No, but many OS researchers say that even though, yes, Linux and other Unix-like OSs have decided fork is the way, that maybe it isn't what we should use. This provocative paper from the Hot Topics in Operating Systems workshop says that we catalog the ways in which fork is a terrible abstraction for the modern programmer to use and describe how it compromises OS implementations and propose alternatives. So there's a lot of reasons not to like fork, but it's what Unix is kind of stuck with. And for the most part, the moves away from fork have been not been things like POSIX spawn, which are just a new API, but just little changes, things that are like fork, but a little different. Yes?
What do you mean by API in the
test function? What I mean by API? API means the interface for an application programmer. So if you're writing a program to run other programs, you're gonna call fork. So it's part of the API that you as an application programmer writer use. Yes? Question is POSIX spawn create the same as the Windows create process? It serves the same niche. The interface is very different. But it does the same thing, yes.
Could you do the same thing with like forking exec? If you just like allocated the memory within the new process control block, if there was like a command to do that, and then run exec?
Question, could I do the same thing as forking exec by allocating the memory for the process control block? So to do that, you need to have, it needs to be in the kernel, right? Because it's not going to be accessible to user program. But sort of, I think what POSIX spawn envisioned is that they would have a system call that did something like that, that this would be implemented using. Yeah?
Are we ever going to use POSIX spawn?
I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm not going to stop it. On the shell assignment where you could absolutely use it if you wanted, but I wouldn't recommend it. And I'm not going to teach how to use it, so. But it could absolutely solve the shell assignment. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Does the shell or the operating system call fork?
Does the shell or the operating system call fork? The programs call fork. Fork is usually a system call. Okay. So we talked about creating new programs, but one thing we didn't talk about is waiting for them to finish. So that's going to be done with a function called waitPID. There's also a function called wait that I just want to mention exists, but we're going to learn waitPID. So waitPID is a library function which takes a process ID to wait for and a place to put the status of the process, which is basically going to be how did it finish? And also some options. We're going to just always pass 0 in my examples, but there are some ways you can change how the waiting happens. And you might say, what if I don't know which process to wait for? So we mentioned earlier on, you can call fork lots of times to have more than one child process. So, and if you do that, you can pass -1 as your PID and wait. And I also mentioned earlier, someone asked, oh, do we remember what our, this, do child processes remember what their parent process is? And the answer was yes. And the reason why is that when you call wait, notice I said here, it waits for a child process to finish. So this has to be a process you previously forked. You cannot wait for a process that you didn't create. If you want to do that, that's not a feature POSIX provides, though there might be ways of doing it that are more like Linux or some other, or OS X or similar specific. So it waits for a process you spawn to finish, either the one with a PID you specify, or you can specify minus one to wait for whichever one finishes first. Yeah. Question, what's the use case of this? So some people asked earlier about what goes in the parent process part of that fork and exec thing. Typically, the parent process wants to wait for us to like finish running OS. This is how you do that. So we'll see some examples in a bit. So one thing you might wonder, what is the status thing? I said it's status information. What is that? So one thing that helps contains is that, remember in main, you can like return values, or you can pass values to exit. That's part of the status information, is that what value did you exit with? And Unix has a convention where zero represents this command worked correctly, and not zero represents it didn't. So like ls will exit with this exit zero if it listed things successfully, and exit with something else, like if you tried to list a directory that didn't exist. So let's look at how wait PID works. So typically, we'll use wait PID, you know, alongside fork because, well, we can only wait for a process we created with fork. So, or something else. So we'll call, so in our parent process, we can take our child PID and wait for it and put its status somewhere. So if we do this, then we will not get out of this then block here until the child process finishes. Some questions? This, yeah.
So this is always what happens, like 15 slides ago when we had the child process and then the child process.
So the question is, this is typically what will happen when we do fork and exec. And yes, so this is typically in our fork exec example, what would be here? I say typically because, well, you don't have to do that. If you want to do other things while OS is running, you can also do that if you just don't wait. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Does exec preserve the PID?
Does exec preserve the PID? Yes.
So if you have multiple children and you run wait PID with negative one,
question, if you have multiple children and you want to wait PID with negative one, it will wait for all of them. It will wait for the first one to complete, and it returns as its return value which one completed. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Status isn't actually specified in
that
code, right?
Status isn't actually specified in this code. Here we pass a pointer because we have to pass one and don't use it. Now, if we want to interpret the status encodes how the program exited, and it's actually kind of like a little struct that's encoded as an integer. So there's these macros in syswait.h, which start with a capital W, to decode that. So here I'm asking, does the status indicate it exited normally versus like segfaulting? And if so, I can retrieve what exit was called with or what was returned from main, called the exit status. But the status can also encode things like if it's killed by what's called a signal. And this is how Unix represents like a segfault, for example. So a segfault is going to be killed by a signal representing a segmentation fault. And there's a bunch of other things like that. So signals, we're not going to talk about them much, but they're meant to be a way of communicating with processes. But like there's one of them that corresponds to control C. There's one that corresponds to a segmentation fault. There's one that corresponds to killed by the kill command. And that's why you can retrieve this signal information, so that will tell us it didn't exit, it was segfaulted, or it was control seed. That's how we'll find that out. Okay, some questions about decoding this exit status, the status information? So we see our typical pattern. We'll go through this next time and start talking about dealing with file descriptors.